Okay, we're beginning here on the bottom, Ayin Gimel Amud Bet, two lines from the bottom. Well, the Rav Ashi, Mishnah Mehad Etnan. Why is his opinion here different than what we see in the Mishnah that we'll see later on in the Masechta? Imovir v'lo avid. If I leave it vacant, if I do not plant it, Eshalem b'metva. I will pay the value or the equivalent value that had been planted and produced. So here's an individual who is hired as a sharecropper on the field, and he says he's going to pay for the out of the produce or out of the production of the field each year. But he also makes a deal that if he doesn't plant the field in a given year, he still will pay as if he did plant the field. So there we say later on in the Gemara that that is fine. So why don't we consider that to be an asmachta? Because the way that he's structuring it is that he plans to plant the field in each year that he has it. And he's going to pay a percentage out of the field. He says to the guy, if I don't plant the field, I'll still pay you. Why isn't that considered to be asmachta, where basically you're promising something where you don't intend for that to be the outcome? Because that's obviously not profitable for him. If he doesn't plant, then he still has to pay for the land or pay a percentage of what would have been the production of the field. He's not going to make money. So he's saying it, but the truth is he doesn't have intention for something like that. So why isn't that classified to be an asmachta? Rav Ashi just said before, when you purchase wine on behalf of someone else, he sent you to purchase the wine. If they said yayin zeh, if he said this particular wine, it's clearly an asmachta, because he knows when he gives you the money to purchase that wine, he may not be able to get that wine. You ask for a very particular wine, we're not certain that he'll get it. Rav Ashi came along and said, even if you say generically, buy me wine, it's still an asmachta. And even if the person said, if I don't buy you the wine now at the cheaper price, I'll buy it for you at the more expensive price, that's an asmachta, because he intends to buy it now at the cheaper price. And the individual thought that he would do it that way, but never expected him to have to pay the higher price. And therefore the kinyan is, or the structure of the agreement, is an asmachta. What the Gemara wants to know is, why over there by the yayin does Rav Ashi say that's an asmachta? And over here by the field, does he not call it an asmachta? The Gemara answers a very important distinction. Hotom biyodo, hocho la biyodo. Depends on whether it's in his control or it's not in his control. So Tosafot already asks, what do you mean in his control? Tema, mai havitve biyodo hotom mihocho. Why is something here more in his control than less than in his control? In the two scenarios, one is the scenario where he's planting the field, and the other scenario is where he is buying the wine. He says, why is one more in his control than the other one? So in the end, he says, v'yesh lomar, d'hochein b'yado k'shar azol, that in the case of purchasing the wine, what he doesn't control is the market price. And therefore, it's out of his control, because the market can fluctuate without his input into the market. And so therefore, he can't guarantee to get it at the lower price. He can buy it now and have it at the lower price, but after he misses that window, there's no guarantee that he can control the situation. On the other hand, aval be'im ovir biyado liknot chitim. If he leaves the field fallow for that year, then he can go into the market and buy wheat at whatever the price is in the market and replace the wheat that he had. It has nothing to do with cheap or expensive. It has to do with him replacing the produce that he didn't have. And that is in his control, because he's not looking for a particular price, he's looking for a particular product. And that product is always available, just depends what price you want to pay for it. But that he can always supply. On the other hand, when it comes to procuring the wine at the lower price, that's not something that he can always do or something that's in his control. There he's subject to the vagaries of the market. And that's why Tosfot says, Hotam biyado, in the case of the field that's in his control, because he can always procure the wheat if he doesn't plow, if he doesn't plant it, if he leaves it fallow. Over here by the wine, lachala biyado, it's not in his control. Rashi says, shalem elo yimchruulo, because maybe the sellers won't sell it to him. That seems like less likely, and that's why Tosafot opts for the other reasoning, which is, what does it mean they don't want to sell it to him? If you're asking for generic wine, then obviously you're going to find it. Now, it's going to be that nobody's going to sell him wine. It's an open market. It's a very large market for wine. You always will find wine. So that's not the problem necessarily. Tosafot says the problem is, will he get it at the price that he's supposed to get it at? When he misses the window, when it's cheaper, will he be able to procure it at the cheaper price? That is la biyodo, and therefore it is an asmachta. Now, Tosafot over here says, from here, mikan, kashal Rabbeinu Tam. Rabbeinu Tam says it's a question on Rashi's interpretation of the Gemara in Sanhedrin. I mentioned this back when we did the sugya of asmachta here in the perek. When we discussed asmachta, I discussed over there, there's a tosfot over there, and I mentioned the tosfot in other places in Shas, in Sanhedrin, here, and other places in Shas, discusses different tiers of asmachta. Asmachta, we said, is where someone enters into an agreement, but they really don't intend for the outcome or the recourse or whatever they agree to happen. And since they don't really believe it's going to happen, they don't really believe they're going to have to pay whatever it is, it's not a full-fledged kinyan. They don't have gemira tadat. They're just saying it in order to enter the transaction, or they're just saying it because they don't believe it will happen. So Tosafot says, our gemara here distinguishes an asmachta between whether it's in your control or out of your control. And the gemara says, the more control you have, the more likely you are to have gemira tadat. The more likely you are to enter into the transaction and say, what I said, I meant. The less control you have, the more the asmachta, because you're promising something that you can't necessarily fulfill. And so therefore, it's more of an asmachta. So from here, the Rabbeinu Tam questions Rashi's interpretation in the Gemara in Sanhedrin. The Gemara in Sanhedrin speaks about mesachek bekubya, which is a major area of asmachta, gambling. A person who is gambling, and they put money into the game, is there an asmachta? I mean, is a problematic kinyan? Because when he puts money into the game, he puts money into the game assuming that he's going to win, and he's going to get all the money back. He doesn't put the money in thinking he's just throwing his money away, and so therefore the Gemara calls that an asmachta. Later on, the Gemara says that Masechet Kubya is lav asmachta. Maybe it's not an asmachta. And Rashi explains over there why. So Perish HaKunch is assumed Eichi Dame Asmachta. You're going to Imovir Velo Avit. What's a classic example of an asmachta? Our case, the case of the Mishnah, Baba Metziah, which is supportive of the Ramban's view that the case of Imovir Velo Avit, Ashalem Bemetva, that Mishnah later on in Baba Metziah, is actually really an asmachta. And it's only the fact that the Chachamim are mitakein that it's binding, even though it's an asmachta, because they felt that that was a reasonable type of agreement to enter into. But later on in the Tosafot, it sounds much more like the fact that he believes that that's not an asmachta whatsoever. So it happens to be machloket between the Ramban and the Balei Tosafot as to what the status of that Mishnah is later on. Could go mashlish taro to get pashut. Or the case in Baba Batra, where he hands over the contract, it's really an outstanding debt, to a third party, and he says, I paid a part of it back. If I don't pay the remainder of it back, you give it back to the creditor. So then in that case, he's going to have to repay the whole debt again. He loses the half that he paid already, because he says, if I don't pay the remainder until that time, give it to the other party. Those are asmachta. Why? The samich adavar. He's relying on something. Kisavur kozebi adol asot. He has the ability to do this. But over here, aval misachek bekubya, lo sameich amidit, lo yoda, yinatzeach, lo yinatzeach. By misachek bekubya, he doesn't rely on anything because it's a game of chance. And if it's a game of chance, he surrenders himself to the chances or to the probabilities that are embedded in the game. So Rashi over there distinguishes between things where you have absolutely no control. And when you have no control, Rashi says, that's not an asmachta anymore. Because you know from the outset that that is the way that this will turn out. And when you put your money down on the game, or you're gambling, you know you're entering into the probabilities of whatever will happen. Whichever way the die rolls, whichever way the cards come out, you know that that is the way that the game is played, and you are taking your chances. So you surrender your money because you know that's the game of chance that you are entering. On the other hand, in cases where you think you have control, or you think you're going to be able to prevent it, over there, that's an asmachta, because you don't believe you'll come to the negative outcome. For instance, the better examples in Baba Batra, where you paid back half of the outstanding debt, then you hand the contract, the outstanding credit note, to a third party, and you say, if I don't pay it back within such and such a time, hand it back to the creditor. And then you'll become obligated in the full amount again. So over there, the reason you did that or entered into that transaction is because you believed you were going to pay the other half off, and would never come to the situation in which you're going to have to pay the whole debt over again. So that case where it's in your control, and you think you have the ability to manage the situation, that's where it's an asmachta. Tosafot says, our Gemara says just the opposite. Our Gemara here says that when it is in your control, that's not called an asmachta. When it's out of your control, that's called an asmachta. Rashi is saying the opposite. He's saying when gambling, when it's out of your control, that's not an asmachta. Where you think you have control, that is considered to be an asmachta. So Rashi seems to interpret in the Gemara and Sanhedrin just the opposite of our Gemara. And that's what Tosafot says. The Rabbeinu Tam takes issue with Rashi Our Gemara seems to indicate the opposite. Tosafot in the end comes up with three tiers, and this is what I mentioned before in explaining Asmachta. There are two extremes, and then there's a middle ground. And the middle ground is where the problem of Asmachta exists, which is that certain areas where it's completely out of your control, that's not Asmachta. That's Mesachek Bekubya. That's the gambling situation. In that situation, you know for certain you have no control over the outcome, and you're entering the game knowing you have no control over the outcome, and it's subject to luck. Whatever the mazel is, whatever comes up, whatever cards come up, whatever the die rolls, that's what's going to be. Since you have absolutely no control, no asmachta. The other side, there are situations in which you have complete control over the situation. And since you have complete control of the situation, that's also not an asmachta. That's the case here. Im ovir velo avid. If I leave it fallow when I don't plant it, I'll pay you anyway. That's a situation where it's completely in your control. Either because you could have planted it and you decided not to, or even if you don't plant it, you have the ability to go on the market and procure whatever it is and pay him for it. Since that is totally within your control, that is something where you have gemirat hadat. The cases that are asmachta are cases that sit between those two extremes. That's where you have the problem of an asmachta, which is the fact that you believe you have control over the situation, but the truth is you're not in complete control over the situation. So for instance, he gives example there of cock races, where they're racing whatever animals. So there, the person believes that he can either pick the right animal that runs the quickest, or that he's gonna scream at the animal or push the animal and it'll run faster. So there he believes that it's not just subject to the probabilities, but he has a skill that will somehow make it better, and he will win in that case. I would say the difference may be in the example of where a person is playing poker, which is not just a game of chance, but it's also a game of strategy. So there, a person thinks that they control the situation. They think, okay, whatever cards I get, yes. But then you have strategy of how to play the cards that you have and what decisions to make. Over there, a person may have an asmachta because he really thinks he can control the outcome or he's going to win. In cases of complete chance, like roulette, or something where it's just a number that falls, over there, it's not a game of strategy, it's a game of chance completely. There, he would surrender to the chance. So that would be the difference of that middle ground where you think you have control, and in thinking that you have control, that's where you have an asmachta, because the person never believes he'll get to the negative outcome because he thinks he can control the situation. But he doesn't have total control, and that's the problem. Over here, for instance, in our case, where he's procuring the wine. He has control in buying the wine. What he doesn't control is the market price. That's away from him, and that's something where he can't guarantee it, or he never really relies on the fact that he is not going to end up with the right market price, or he's going to have to buy at the higher price, and there's where you have an asmachta. So that's one form of asmachta. The other form of asmachta is what we call gazim, where a person exaggerates, where a person says something that is ridiculous. So there are two forms of gazim. One form of gazim is that the person exaggerates because he never believes that that will happen. So for instance, that might be the case in Baba Batra with the debt, where he's repaid half the debt. He hands the contract, the outstanding note, to a third party and says, if I don't pay back by a certain time, the remainder of the debt, hand it back to the creditor, and he'll have the full amount. Now obviously that's a ridiculous penalty, that he's going to have to repay the whole debt just because he didn't pay the other half back. But he's saying that because he never believes he'll get to that. So that's called gazim. Now, sometimes gazim is done in order to engender belief or believability from the other party. That's what we had back in this perek, where the asmachta was, the person is saying, if such and such happens, I'll pay you double or I'll do something. What he's trying to do is make the person believe that he really is going to do what he said, because otherwise there'll be a penalty. That's another form of gazim, again, where there's an asmachta. The person never believes that they will ever have to come to that outcome. They're not committing themselves to that outcome. They're doing it to make you believe them that they're actually going to carry out whatever they said they would carry out. So therefore, that's what Tosva does in this over here. Explain, first of all, there are three tiers in terms of asmachta, control or lack of control. And then within the world of gazim, that there is two forms of gazim. One form of gazim is that he's exaggerating because he doesn't believe he's going to ever come to that outcome. Or the other gazim is just trying to engender trust from the other party, but not that he believes or really is entering himself into that transaction, believing he's going to have to do that or he's ever going to do it. So that's what Tosfot explains, Asmachta in a bigger picture, and also reconciles between what we have here and the Gemara in Sanhedrin with regards to gambling. Amar Rava, Hani Blei Tlata, De'avei Zuzi Dechad. These three people gave money over to an individual to, we'll call it invest on their behalf, but it's really purchasing items on their behalf. The Mizman Lahu Midei, to purchase an item, V'zavan Dechad Minayu, and he purchased sufficient for one of them. Zvan Nekuhu. Then he didn't really purchase for that one, he purchased for all three of them. Which means that when he goes out and they've all given him money to purchase, we do it on a pro rata basis. We don't say that he went in and out and bought it for one particular individual, the other two, bad luck, he didn't get it for you. We say no, that when he went out and purchased it, on a pro rata basis, we're going to give it to each of the parties that gave him money until we fulfill the order of each individual. And I think the Ramban even indicates here, even if he specifies, even if he says, I'm buying it for so-and-so, it's overridden by the fact that he was given money by all three parties, and he's really acting as an agent of all three parties, and not of one particular party. That is only true that when they gave over the money, that they didn't, they gave over the money separately. I mean, if each one of them gave over a pouch that was sealed and separate, then really they are not acting in concert, they're acting independently. And that means that each buyer or each person that is sending him independently, and he can work independently for each individual. The problem was before was, in a sense, they pooled their money, or they brought their money together and they didn't segregate it. So then when he buys, he's buying into the pool, he's not buying for one particular individual. Aval tsar v'chatim, inish inish l'chudei. But if each one of them handed him a separate pouch of money, or signed a separate contract with him, engaged him separately, then he can work independently for each one. If he bought for a particular individual, then it's for that individual. And if he states that, then that's the case. And you can't say, oh, then he has to give it to each of them pro rata, because they didn't come in together as a single pool of money or a purchasing pool. In the first case, they're coming in either together as a purchasing pool, or they all gave him money, but they didn't separate or segregate their monies. They simply hand him the monies. In that instance, we assume when he goes out and buys, he's buying on behalf of the pool or behalf of all the parties that engaged him. So the man de zavin, zavin, the man de lo zavin, and therefore the one he purchased for, the one he didn't purchase for, he didn't purchase for. Amar Papi Mishmei de Rava, hai situmta kanya. This, Rashi calls this situmta a seal. It is some indication that the person has bought it. In the modern day, it is when they put a sold sign on the house or on some sort of merchandise. Here it's a case where, let's for instance, the retailer is buying from the supplier, but the retailer can't inventory everything he's bought from the supplier. So he leaves the inventory with the supplier, and the supplier marks whatever barrels he sold to this retailer with some marking saying that it's sold already. So he puts that stamp or whatever the sold sign is, but for whatever particular individual on it. There's a rishima. There's some sort of marking or indication that it was sold, and it was sold for this particular individual. So now you're missing a halachic kinyan. There was no kinyan mishicha. There was no formal kinyan that makes it that he owns it. All they did was they put this seal on the barrel saying it's relegated or it's reserved for this particular individual. But Rav Papa Mishmei de Rava says, "Hai situmta kanya." That makes it into a kinyan. L'may hilchata. What normative implications does that have? Rav Chaviva Amar Lemiknaya Maimash means literally, it's a kinyan. It takes on the full force of halacha kinyan. Rabbanan Amar Lekubalui Elei Misha Para doesn't have the full force of a kinyan, but it's the equivalent of a, call it a substandard kinyan, which enters you into a situation where you are not allowed to back out. And if you back out, you're going to be subject to a klala. But it's not legally binding where the court can enforce it and force you to carry through on it. So there are penalties for backing out, which is you'll be cursed, but there is no legally binding agreement over here where the court would enforce it. The hilchata on the loch is the kulele misha para. It says that is, the loch is that it's subject to misha para, doesn't form a full-fledged kinyan. Uba atra de nehige le mikne mamash kanu. In a place where the minog is that this is a form of kinyan, kanu, then they are full-fledged kinyan over here. So what the Ramban suggests over here is that here you see the tremendous power of minhag. The tremendous power of minhag is that if the practice in this area is to generate kinyanim in this way, it takes on the force of a kinyan de oraita. and it's a full-fledged kinyan. There are some that only suggest that it's a kinyan midirabanan. But the Ramban says that in a makom, that is the minhag, it takes on the full force of a kinyan d'oraita. From this you see the power of minhag. If this is the custom, the practice of that location, it now takes on the force of a Torah kinyan. And therefore, if you put the seal on there, you can't back out of the transaction. It's an enforceable transaction. And so here you see that seal or that item that they place on the barrels, you're obligated then to carry through or stand by the transaction, because that is the minhag makom. And that might have, again, implications today. I've heard from Rabbanan about faxes today. If in a situation, the minhag makom is that when you sign and you send something through a fax, that's a legally binding agreement, then that might be enough to make it legally binding halakhically. Just like if you were entering into a contract with another party and you signed the contract and then faxed it to them, that would be a legally binding agreement. So too, if you do that in a halakhic context, it should be legally binding, because that's the minhag hamakom. So you see that sometimes the minhag hamakom can be so strong or so powerful that it then takes on normative implications for the halacha. And that's what our Gemara says over here, at least according to some of the Rishonim. And therefore, in the modern day, if there are mechanisms by which electronic signature, faxes, areas where they are considered legally binding, and that is the common practice, then those would take on halachic ramifications as well. If you sign the contract for Mechirat Chametz, and then you fax it to the Rav, is that a binding agreement? Can he enter into the agreement for you and be your shliach to sell the chametz? And the answer might be yes, because that is the minhag makom. I had a situation like that, and Rav Willig suggested that I could sign it and send the fax, since it's legally binding, that also has normative implications of halacha, and I can make him into my shliach to sell the chametz based on the fax that I sent him. Hayahu tchila l'kotzrim. He was the first of the harvesters. In the Mishnah, it says that he's allowed to then sell it at whatever price he agrees to with the party, because he now has it in hand. Remember, the two exceptions to the rules of selling for forward delivery are if yatzah shar, if there is a open and clear market price, because then you can go out into the market and replace it, or you have it in hand. So this individual who was an early harvester, he has it in hand. Since he has it in hand, he can sell it for forward delivery, because then it's as if the buyer takes possession of it immediately, and if it appreciates in price, it appreciates to the buyer. And that's why it's fine. But the question is, when you say tchila l'kotzrim, that just because the guy harvested the wheat doesn't mean that he has the produce or the product that you're trying to buy. You're buying flour. You're trying to buy wheat kernels. Whatever it is that you're buying, there's still processing that needs to be done between the harvest and the time that you get the product that he wants. The question really is, at what point is it considered that he has the product in hand? So Amarav, Mechusa Shtayim Posek, Shalosh Enu Posek. If there are two more parts of the processing left, that's already considered as if you have it in hand. If there's three more processes that you have to go through to get to the end product that you are selling, then you cannot sell it forward because you don't have it in hand. There's too much to do between what you have now and what you are promising to give, that it's not considered as if you have it as in hand. Shmuel Amar Bidei Adam Afilu Me'ah Posek. Shmuel says, if it's in your control, doesn't matter how many steps there are in the process to get it to the finished product that you're promising, that is fine because it's in your control. Bidei Shamayim, if it is out of your control, then Afilu Achat Enu Posek. Then you have no right to be Posek based on that. Because if you say that I have the product in hand, you could go say, I have a field full of wheat. And since I have a field full of wheat, or a field that's growing wheat, I can sell it forward because I have it. Well, you can't say that, because that's subject to weather, that's subject to other natural disasters, problems of pests, other things that could happen that could ruin the wheat that's growing there. That's not in your control. Since it's out of your control, you can't claim that you already have it in hand. Even if it's not harvested yet, you can't claim it's in hand, because something could go wrong between that time and the time that you harvest it, out of your control. Once it's already in your control, and the only thing separating between what you've promised and what you have is you're doing the work or the processing, that's fine according to Shmuel. Tanan, our Mishnah says, Posek imo ala gadish. You're allowed to be posek with him when you are at the piles, when the stuff is already piled up. Veha mechusar, at that point in time, you are engaging in a sale for forward delivery. According to Rav, you can only have two melachot left. Yet, what the Gemara is going to show here is that there are more melachot left than two. First of all, mishto bechamal miyabish. You have to put it out in the sun to dry out. Ulameidash, you have to do dash, you have to thresh it. Umidra, and then you have to do zore la ruach. Then you have to winnow it in order to get the kernels and get rid of all the chaff that is there. So if that's the case, you have three stages left in the processing. And yet our Mishnah says, posekim ala gadish. You're allowed to sell for forward delivery once the gadish is there. So Gemara says, kagon deshada bechama v'yavash. It's a case where you already put it out in the sun, it was dry. It's a gadish, but a gadish that's been sitting in the sun for a while, so it's already dried out. So then you only have two more stages left, which is the dash and the zore l'ruach. Shmuel amar bidei shamayim. Shmuel says that when it's out of your control, then afilu achat enu posek, even if there's one process left, you're not allowed to do it. V'hamechuser midra. It's missing zore l'ruach to bidei shamayimi. That's not in your control. In order to winnow, you need wind. So that's not in your control. You need the wind to be blowing in order to throw it up with the pitchfork and have the chaff blow away and be able to keep that which you want. Mar says, Efshar benafata. There is a way to circumvent winnowing, which is that you do it through a sieve. It's a more laborious and slow technique, which is that you put everything through the sieve and then you take out the chaff and you keep the kernels. But there is a way to do this without the wind. So since there is a way to circumvent it, according to Shmuel, that's not considered to be out of your control, or bidei shemayim, that's still bidei adam. Because even if the wind doesn't show up, you'll do the other method or other processing, so it's considered as if you have it in hand now, and you can sell it forward. Valavit shalanavim, and the Mishnah says that you can sell forward a tub of grapes. Va'amechusar, a tub of grapes, in terms of processing, is missing the following. Michmar, to allow the grapes to sit there, and soften, and almost a little bit rot, so that they become ready for pressing. V'yulei debei ma'atzarta, and then you have to take it into the press itself. Ulemidash, and then you have to press it. Ulemingad, and then you have to open it up to flow to the bore, which is that once you've gone through the press, you have to open up the pipe that allows it to go back down to what's called the bore, the area where they store the wine. So here you have numerous processes left, and yet we're saying that you could sell it for forward delivery. Kedetani Rabbi Chiya ala komer shel zeitim, as we're going to see in about a minute in the Gemara, that Rabbi Chiya says with regards to the vat of olives, hachanami al komer shel anavim. So too here we're speaking about a tub of anavim where they've already softened. They've already gotten through or far enough through the process by which they're sitting in this tub, or they're sitting in this vat, and they're already softened. So that process is already done. So that's why we're speaking about it. Where it says, v'amechusrei tzlat, you're still missing three things, which is taking it from the tub or vat and putting it into the press. And then after you put it into the press, you need to press it. And then after you've pressed it, you've got to drain it out into the storage vat. Batra da'u d'zavin hu d'nagid. In that place, it was the minhag, or the practice, that the person who bought it was the one who drained it from the press into the bore. So he already got involved in the process at that point. So between what you need to do and where he turn comes into the picture, there are only two processes left, and that is putting it in the press and pressing it. Once you've already pressed it, that's what he wanted. He wanted to press grapes, and he'll open up the drain pipe and allow it to flow into the bore. Valamatan shel zeitim, and the vat of olives. And again here, v'amechusar michmar, it's missing allowing them to sit and soften. V'yuled beidape, and bringing them into the beitabad, into the olive press. V'ulemeidash, and then to press them. Ulemingad, and then to flow it from the press into whatever storage area you keep them in. So Tani Rabbi Chiya, this is where Rabbi Chiya said his statement, al komer shel zeitim, that it was already softened olives. It's not that they're sitting in the vat waiting to soften. They're in the vat and already softened. Where it still says, Vayikat Tzlat. There's still three processes left, which is putting it into the Beit Abad, pressing it, and then draining it out of the Beit Abad into the storage area. Ba'atra dahu dezavin hu mangid. Again, the same practice here, which is that the person who purchased it, he already gets involved at that time, and he's the one who drains it down into the bore. He already takes over the processing at that point. So therefore, there's only two steps that are missing. The step of putting it into the press and the step of actually pressing it. Vala beitzim shel yotzer. and the eggs of the powder, again, not literally eggs, but they are blocks of clay, but they used to keep the blocks of clay in circles or oval-shaped items, and so they looked like a beitzah. They looked like a egg. And that's how they stored it before they started working on it. So we said that the potter, once he has those eggs of clay, he can already sell it for forward delivery. Amai, why is that true? Va'amechusar lefufei, it's missing. Rashi gives two interpretations here, either being wrapped up or migalgel, rolling it and shaping it. So it's missing that. V'yivushe, and drying it out. Iyule da tuna the misraf, and then putting it into the kiln to fire it. Or the mepak, and then to take it out of the kiln once it's finished. You're going to sell them a finished, made utensil. Meantime, the engaging in the purchase is at the time when it's just this egg of clay. So here we see there are numerous steps in the process that have to go on between those two. And why is that okay according to Rav? Where it says, Kugon de melafafa v'yavishu. It's a case where they already rolled it, or wrapped it, and dried it out. V'hai katzlat. There's still three stages left, which is iyule letuna, putting it into the kiln, misraf, and then the firing it in the kiln, the mepak, and taking it out. V'atra da'u de'zavin hu de'mepik. Again, in that place or that location, the practice was the purchaser took it out of the oven. So therefore, there's only two stages left, which is putting in the oven and firing up the oven in order to harden it. But the taking out of the oven is not a step that is missing because that step is done by the buyer. And the lime, once it's already in the furnace, again here, it's missing a number of stages. Mechusar mikle, it's missing being burnt, vafuke, and then taking it out of the furnace, umedak, and then crushing it. So the way that they made the lime was that they heated it up, whatever the items or the raw materials were, they made them into like a brick shape. They used to fire up the furnace, put them in the furnace until it hardened the brick, and after the brick came out, they would crush the brick into a powder, and that made the lime or the cement-like material that they were looking for. So here you have three stages left, and yet we're saying that it's fine to sell it for forward delivery. In that city or that place, the minhag was that whoever purchased it was the one who crushed it. You served him bricks. That's what you gave to him. So you put it in the furnace, you hardened it into a brick, and then you handed him those bricks, and he did the crushing to make it into a powder. So now we're only missing two processes. Ushmol damar bidei adam afilu mea posek. According to Shmuel, who says that you can do as many processes as you want, as long as it's up to you and it's in your control, then why does the Mishnah specifically say, once you put it into the oven, then you're allowed to sell it for forward delivery? For Shmuel, you could do it even before you put it in the oven, because it's just man-made steps that need to go on. So it says, Ema mishira uy lishak obikivshan. Not that literally it was put in the oven, but once it is ready to be put in the oven, Shmuel thinks at that point you could sell it because there's everything else that's left is bidei adam. Everything else left is in a human control because of putting in the oven, firing up the oven, heating it up, drying it out, and then crushing it are things that were in man's control to do. The Gemara goes back to this idea with the clay of the potter. Tarabanan, in poskim ala beitzim sheyotzer ad sheyasu. You're not allowed to sell for forward delivery a utensil until you have in hand the actual clay that you're going to use, these clay beitzim. Tibi Rabbi Meir. That's Rabbi Meir's opinion. Amar Rabbi Yossi, b'me dvarim omrim. He qualifies Rabbi Meir's statement and says that's only true ba'afar lavan. When you're talking about clay or powder that they use to make the clay utensil, which is a much finer and cleaner clay or charasit, they call it, which is very white. It made a higher quality and a better colored utensil. V'bafar shachor, afar shachor is, again, the raw material used for making the clay, but usually it's mixed with some dirt in it. It's of a lower quality, but also comes out with a darker color when you make it. To buy afar lavan, that is true, you need to have it in hand. By afar shachor, you don't need to have it in hand. Kagon, kfar chanya v'chavrotah, like kfar chanya and its suburbs, Kfar Shichin v'chabotah, Kfar Shichin and its suburbs, because poskim afo pishin lezeh yesh lezeh. You're allowed to contract for forward delivery because even if you don't have it, someone else has it. Meaning in that area, that raw material was readily available and many potters worked there. These were centers of commerce, but centers of potters. And so therefore, even if a potter agrees for future delivery of a kli, then even if he doesn't have the clay in hand, he can still do it because he can always procure the clay quickly, either by borrowing it from his friends or getting a new mound of clay because it was easily either extracted or many people had it in that area, and therefore it's considered as if you have it in hand. Final product is actually the clay in both these cases. In one case in our mission, it's talking about you have to have the clay in hand, whereas over here it's saying that maybe you don't need the clay in hand because you can procure the afar that is needed. Tosafot already questions that and says, wait a minute, lo mairi ba'afra, can't be talking about the charasit or the raw material here, da'amachusa shaloshu, because then you're missing three stages and it'll be a problem for Rav. Because then, remember, before we said, well, even with the beitzim, it was questionable that there were only two stages left. The only reason he said it was two stages is because the buyer took it out of the oven. But now if you take one more stage back, which you say that it is a fire, and you've yet to put the water in and mix it, then you're too far back. So Tosfot says, "Veinu pasekel bebeitzim ayri." The case there also, the afra, is also about the beitzim. That you're allowed to be posek al beitzim. Not on the afar, but on the beitzim. The question is, what's the raw material that went into the beitzah? If you have a beitzah that's made out of the white raw material, the white charasit, in that case, you have to have it in hand in order to sell it for forward delivery. On the other hand, if you are using the raw material that is this black charasit or the darker charasit, in that case, even if you don't have the beitzah in hand, you can get that beitzah from someone else because it's so readily available in this location. That's the way Tosafot, in order to avoid the problem of this being too far back in the processing. The other thing he says is, mashmash yesh shar b'shuk lebeitzim. He says the other thing that comes out of this is that it sounds like there is a regular market price or a market for these beitzim. And that's the equivalent in our Mishnah. By the Mishnah, when you have a full-fledged market price out there, a deep and strong market price out there, you're allowed to be posek for future delivery even if you don't have it in hand. And that's basically what we're saying over here, is that beitzim have a market in these locations where there were numerous people involved in this trade. And therefore he says, the beitzim, l'inyan kederot, when it comes to the beitzim in terms of forming finished clay products, arkein l'kukot, the mochrei tvua. They are the equivalent of the people who are aggregators by tvua, or the aniyim that go around and collect the wheat from different fields. So they're the same thing. So it's a early individual where they come in much earlier than the normal market, because if you're selling kederot, there's clearly a market for that type of thing, and that's a deep and wide market because everybody sells clay utensils. The question is here, further back, is there a market for these beitzim, these blocks or these eggs of clay? And that's what we're saying here. There is a market, but it's a very particular market. It's a particular market for people involved in this item. It's not a broad market where you go and buy utensils at that point in time. Tosafot says, or you can suggest that over here there isn't a market for these items, but since it's so commonplace in these cities, people would borrow from each other. So if you don't have it, you could just borrow it from your potter friend, then you replace it and it'd be fine. So it's the equivalent, or as if you have it in hand. Ameimar Yabi Zuze, Michi Aile Afra. Ameimar used to give money once they brought in the afar, the raw material he was going to use in order to make the utensil. Come on, who does he hold like? Iker Rabbi Meir, if he holds like Rabbi Meir, Amar Ajiasu. He says until the beitzah is made, you can't enter into the agreement. Over here, he's making an agreement for the raw material when he brings in the raw material. Iker Rabbi Yossi, Amar Afopishin Lezeh, Yesh Lezeh. And for Rabbi Yossi, it doesn't really matter. He says, you don't even have to have the afar there because if you don't have it, someone else has it. It's not a problem. So Olam K'Rabbi Yossi. It is like Rabbi Yossi. Ba'atre da Meimar Ashik Afra. That in a Meimar's location, the afar is very expensive. Ve'enu Matsui. And therefore, it wasn't found. So therefore, Idemaili Afra Sam Chadate Ve'emle Zuze. If he already has the raw material in hand, then the person relies on the fact that he's actually going to make the utensil because he has the raw material, he's able to procure it, and therefore when he puts the money down, he's serious and knows that there's a transaction here. Vilo, if he does not yet have the raw material in hand, lo sam chadate. He does not necessarily believe that this individual is able to procure the item, and so therefore when he gives him the money, he's not really closing the deal in terms of a kinyan because he's not sure that the guy's even going to get the raw material. And therefore, there's no smichut adat. And that means that it's not a finalized transaction until he procures the item. That's what Rashi says, is that samchadate tokol echad v'chozer yikabel mishapara. Now remember, you're only putting money down over here, so it's not going to be a full-fledged kinyan, because money only makes a kinyan for mishapara. But that's what Rashi says, that in a case where you already have the afar, both parties are subject to mishapara now once you put down the money, because there he relies on the fact that he's really going to give you the finished product, because he has the raw material in hand. But in the other case, lo samchadate v'leka mishapara. There is no mishapara, shuat smolo nismachalav. Even the buyer is not really relying on him. Elanatan alasafek. You put your money down, hoping that he would procure the raw materials and make it. But since you don't know for sure yet, it's not as if there was an agreement that you have to be bound by, because even when you bought it, it was alasafek. Since alasafek, nobody really is bound or locked in. If either one of them walks away, it would be fine. You wouldn't even be subject to mishapara. Right. The Mishnah says that you're allowed to sell forward dung or fertilizer for the entire year. The Mishnah actually has three opinions on this, which the first opinion is, that's the first, that's the Tanakama. Rabbi Yossi Omer Lola, main poskim al zevel im ken aita lo zevel bashpa. Rabbi Yossi comes along and says you have to have it in possession. V'chachamim matirim, and say that's mutar. So in essence, what's the difference between the Chachamim and the Tanakama? They're both disagreeing with Rabbi Yossi. What's the difference in their opinion? That's what the Gemara asks over here. Chachamim, Hainu Tanakama. Chachamim that disagree with Rabbi Yossi is like the Tanakama who disagrees with Rabbi Yossi. Samarava, Yimotu Gishamim, Ika Benayu. The Nafgamina between them is the winter time, which is that Rabbi Yossi says, unless you have it in hand, you're not allowed to sell it forward. The Tanakama says you can sell it forward any time of the year. Whenever you want, you can sell it forward. The Chachamim Matirim is that they're Matir in the summertime. In the summertime where everybody has dried out dung available, then it's fine for you to sell it forward, because even if you can't supply it yourself, you'll procure it from someone else, and that's fine. But you must look at Shamim in the wintertime where everything's messy and muddy and not everything's dried out, then we're not certain that if you don't have it in hand, you're going to be able to procure it from somewhere else. And therefore the Chachamim say that is problematic. In the Mishnah it says, and machlok between Rabbi Yehuda and the Tanakama, that when you come into an agreement for a price today for future delivery, if the price depreciates between the time that you came into the agreement and the time of delivery, you get the lower price. The machlok in the Mishnah is whether you have to articulate that. If you say it, then it works. If you don't say it, it doesn't. Or is that the default status that you get that price? So Rabbi Yehuda says it's a default, and you automatically get the lower of the two prices. The Tanakhama says, if you enter into agreement like that, it works. If you don't enter an agreement like that, it doesn't work. But what we learn from this is that there is this concept that you can enter in and buy something at the price today for future delivery, and if the future delivery ends up in a situation where the price is lower, then you are able to garner the lower price. Now Rashi over here makes a comment, which I noted in the Mishnah. He says, Akula matniten koi. This machloka between the Tanakhama and Rabbi Yehuda is going in the entire Mishnah. It's qualifying the entire Mishnah. The Mishnah has two cases in it. The Mishnah has a case of posukimo kishar, that you're allowed to be posek when the shar is out, and also has another case, which is if you already have it in hand, if you have it in possession. Rashi says this is qualifying both of those. And it says that in either of those situations, whether you have it in hand, or whether the market price is out, if you sell it today at that discounted price, in the future, if the price is lower, you'll get the lower price at the time of delivery. That's how Rashi reads it. There are many Rishonim that believe that this is only modifying the ratio of the Mishnah, which is the case of Ein Poskim Ajietze Ashar. Only modifying that, it's not modifying the case where you have it in hand. Rashi here is clear that it's going on Kula Matnitin. Now the Gemara brings a scenario. How Gabra? This individual went ahead and put money down for, here it's a dowry, but it doesn't really mean a dowry. It means the dowry kit. He was buying that which would be given to the woman for a dowry. So he's procuring it on behalf of his father-in-law. His in-laws asked him to go ahead and buy them a kit, probably for one of their daughters that they're trying to marry off. So Rashi says that he was getting jewelry, earrings, and all sorts of things that they would put together the trousseau for the young girl who was getting married. Sof zal nadunya. So he entered into the transaction to buy it for forward delivery. And when it came to the time of the delivery, the prices of the nadunya, of that which he had procured, was now much cheaper. Ato the kamei de Rav Papa. They came before Rav Papa, and what do we do now? If you, like the Tanakhama suggests, agreed that you would get the lower of the two prices, which means the lower of the price when you actually bought it, and the price when it is delivered, then you can get the lower price now. Ve'ilo, if you never made that agreement, shakal kamikara, then you got to pay the price that you agreed to up front, because that's what you agreed to. Amrulei Rabbanan de Rav Papa, ve'ilo pasak shakal kamikara. Wait a minute. Why is it, if they didn't come to an agreement about this, that he has to pay based on the original price that he agreed to? Ma'ot ninhu, ma'ot lo kanu. The only thing that went between them, or any kinyan that happened between them, was that he handed over money. Money is not a vehicle for kinyan. Money might lock you into a transaction for misha para. It does not lock you into a transaction where you can't walk away from the transaction. If you're willing to accept the klala, you can walk away from the transaction. So what are you saying here, that it's a binding transaction? He's got to pay it. I didn't mean to say that he can't walk away from the transaction. He could walk away. But he walks away, then he's subject to misha para. So all I'm saying is that he needs to take it at the lower price, or he's going to have to be subject to misha para. Then, if he made the agreement that he gets to lower the two prices, then the seller is the one walking away from it, and mekabalei mocher misha para. Therefore, the mocher is subject to misha para. Because if he said, I get the lower of the price today, or the price at the time of delivery, then when it comes to the time of the delivery, the price is down. If the mocher walks at that time, because he doesn't want to give it to him at the lower price, the mocher is the one subject to misha para. Ilo pasak, if they never made such an agreement, and the price went down, then it's the buyer that's trying to walk, because he wants to buy it at the cheaper price today, not at the more expensive price that he bought it before. Therefore, mikabel alei lokeach misha para. Therefore, the lokeach, the buyer, is subject to misha para. So Rav Papa says you are bound if you do not specifically state that you're getting the lower of the two prices. You're not bound in the sense of it's legally binding or enforceable, but you are subject to misha para. You will be cursed if you walk away because you committed to the transaction. And depending which way you committed to the transaction, if you agreed to get the lower of the two prices, then that commitment is binding, and if the mocher wants to walk away from it, he's the one that's abrogating and not keeping his word, and therefore he's subject to misha para. In a case where you did not agree to the lower of the two prices, you simply bought it at today's price, then you have to pay for it at that price. And if you want to go and, again, abrogate the deal in order to get the lower price, the buyer is the one who's at fault here for breaking the deal, and therefore he's going to be subject to misha para. Amalei Ravina de Rav Papa. Umimai de Rabbonon hi. So Ravina challenges Rav Papa and says, how do you know that the author of our Mishnah and this position is the Rabbonon? The Plige Alei de Rabbi Shimon, that argue on Rabbi Shimon. Damre ma'ot lo kanu. Because they say money does not acquire. It's not a form of kinyan. So vafilu achi. And nevertheless you say, despite the fact that ma'ot is not a kinyan, you say, ipasuk kishar gvoa shakil kadahashta. That if they came to an agreement, or part of the agreement was that he would get the lower of the two prices, then he pays today's price, which is lower. If they did not agree to that, then he's got to pay like the original price, even if the original price is more expensive. How do you know it's the shita of the Rabbanon? Dilma Rabbi Shimoni damar ma'ot konot. Maybe this is Rabbi Shimon who believes that ma'ot konot, where if you go back to Mem Zayin Amud Bet, really on Mem Dalet Amud Aleph, but then on Mem Zayin Amud Bet, there the Gemara discussed about whether there is a kinyan ma'ot. Do ma'ot work as a kinyan? And Rabbi Shimon believes that ma'ot are a full-fledged kinyan, whereas the Chamin believe that ma'ot ain't on konot, or do not acquire. Over there, we also had a machloki between them about who has the right to back out of the transaction. So there Rav Chista said, statement of Rav Chista, I mean Zayin Amud Bet, where Rav Chista says, Damar Rav Chista, kederach she'tiknu mishicha b'mochrim, kach tiknu mishicha b'lekuchot. Just like there's a demand for a kinyan mishicha for the sellers, so too is there a demand of a kinyan mishicha for the lekuchot. And so what Rav Chisda suggests is, according to the Chachamim, both the buyer and the seller do not have a kinyan until there's a kinyan mishicha. Both of them do not have a right to walk away from the transaction if they've done a kinyan mishicha. If there's no kinyan mishicha, both parties are in the same boat and they both can walk. They'll be subject to misha para, but they can both walk. Rabbi Shimon, on the other hand, does not subscribe to Rav Chisda, and therefore Rabbi Shimon says that only the mocher is a din and kinyan mishicha. Only the mocher requires a kinyan mishicha in order to lock him in, whereas the lokeach is locked in once he gives the money. So he gives the money, he's done, because the whole point of the takanat mishicha is that we don't say nisrufu chitecha ba'aliyah. So that the seller doesn't say, your stuff's in the aliyah. So there we made the extra kinyan mishicha in order that the lokeach took it into his possession. Because if he just handed money, the mocher is going to say, it's yours, I don't care about it. But now that we say he needs a kinyan mishicha, it's his until the kinyan mishicha happens. So the takana was for the mocher. Rabbi Shimon says it's the only mocher, but for the lokeach, where it doesn't matter, there's no nafkamina there, even when he gives the money, he is locked in and he cannot walk away from it. So that's what the Gemara said there about Rabbi Shimon. So here, Rabbi Shimon believes ma'ot konot. Ma'ot are successful at generating the kinyan, and you can't walk away from it anymore. So what Ravina is challenging Rav Papa and saying, how do you know the author of our Mishnah is the Rabbonon who say that it is not legally binding, it's only subject to Misha Para? Maybe it's Rabbi Shimon who says that it is legally binding. If they agreed to the lower of the two prices, then he pays the current price, which is lower. Ilo pasak, if he did not do that, shakol kimi kara, then he pays the original price, mishom de kani lahu zuze, because the buyer is locked in by the fact that he paid money already. He put money in, you have a full-fledged kinyan, according to Rabbi Shimon. Aval de Rabbanon, according to Rabbanon, ben pasak, ben lo pasak, doesn't matter whether you entered the agreement or didn't enter the agreement, shakol kimi kara. You take it here. Why? The datid inish atarazila. Because the default scenario is that when person enters into a transaction, he believes he's going to get the lower of the two prices. So what the suggestion is how do you know that the Tanakama in our Mishnah, who argues on Rabbi Yehuda, Rabbi Yehuda says the default situation is that you get the lower price. The Tanakama says only if you agree to that. You need an agreement. So who is the Tanakama? Is the Tanakama the Chachamim? And therefore the Chachamim believe that you're not allowed to walk away from the price in those cases. And certainly Rabbi Shimon will say you can't walk away from the situation. Why don't you say that our Mishnah is Rabbi Shimon? And Rabbi Shimon is the one who's saying that you can't walk away because of ma'ot konot. The money made it a binding transaction. But the Chachamim will agree with Rabbi Yehuda and say that the default scenario is that you get the lower of the two prices and you're not even subject to Misha Para. Obviously this has nafkamina l'alocha, which is then the Chachamim are saying that the default is like Rabbi Yehuda. Why would you want to do that? What's the difference? If it's Rabbi Shimon or the Chachamim, what's Ravina questioning Rav Papa? He thinks it's the Chachamim, you think it's Rabbi Shimon. The answer is, how many machlokot we have over here? If you make the Tanakama of Rabbi Yehuda Rabbi Shimon, then there's only two machlokot here. The Mishnah and our Mishnah, it's Rabbi Shimon and Rabbi Yehuda. And back before, there was also machlokot Rabbi Shimon and the Chachamim. But the Chachamim are Rabbi Yehuda, and therefore there's only two opinions over here. On the other hand, if you make the Chachamim the authors of our Mishnah, and they're arguing with Rabbi Yehuda, that means we now we have three opinions. We have the Chachamim of our Mishnah, you have Rabbi Yehuda of our Mishnah, and then you have Rabbi Shimon. There'll be a three-way machloket. So there is an advantage to explaining our Mishnah like Rabbi Shimon, because then you narrow the scope of the machloket to two rather than three. So that's why you would want to do that. The other benefit is then the Chachamim say that you could, it's by default, you get the lower price, and you could walk otherwise, because that's the nature of transactions. When a person enters into a transaction where there's a price today and a price in the future, he wants the lower of those two prices. Gemara says, Amar Lei, Papa says back to Ravina, Imur Damar Rabbi Shimon Bechatara. Where Rabbi Shimon says you're locked into the transaction when you put down money, that's when there's only one market price. Betray Tare Miamar. But by two market prices, who says that Rabbi Shimon says that? Because Rabbi Shimon at that point says you can walk away from the transaction. Meaning that Rabbi Shimon says you're locked into a transaction when you're talking about a single market price. When you're talking about two market prices, which means the market price today and the market price at the time of delivery, he even agrees there that you can walk away from the transaction. Dilo tema ochit, because if you don't say that, misha para belokeach l'Rabbi Shimon leitle, there will never be a scenario where the lokeach, the buyer, will be subject to misha para. If the buyer is always bound by his putting down the money, and according to Rabbi Shimon, he never has a right to walk away from it, then he's always legally bound in transactions. He can never be in a situation where he's not legally bound, but he's subject to misha para. What's the problem? Why not? That's fine. Va'atanya, we have a braita in which Rabbi Shimon says, Mikomakom kachalacha. This is the way, even though there's no legally binding enforceable transaction here, nevertheless, this is halacha. Amru, hachamim, misha para. The chamim say, whoever walks away from a transaction is subject to misha para. My mikomakom. What does it mean, mikomakom? In all situations, there's still this other part. Lav de loshna lokeach, loshna mocher. Makes no difference whether you are the buyer or the seller. Mikabale misha para. You are subject to misha para. So here we have a braita that is quoting Rabbi Shimon, and he is saying that there is misha para both by the lokeach and by the mocher. Once you have that, you can't say that the lokeach is always locked into his transaction. Ella, ki amar Rabbi Shimon b'chad tara. Where did Rabbi Shimon say the lokeach has no right of retraction? That's when there's only one market price. You're selling it at the price, and you put the money down, you're locked. But in a situation, betray tare, lo amar. When there are two market prices involved, then even the lokeach has a right to walk away. And back on Mem Zayin Amud Bet, the Balei HaTosafot quoted this Gemara to show you that Rabbi Shimon doesn't necessarily believe that the lokeach is always locked in. That even though Rabbi Shimon believes ma'ot are konot, that doesn't mean that the buyer doesn't have a right to walk away from a transaction. And therefore, Tosafot narrows the scope of where Rabbi Shimon says that a buyer is locked into the transaction. V'hadekamar b'shmaitin, Tosafot says, here and back on Mem Zayin Amud Bet, the place that Rabbi Shimon says, the late leader of Chista, that he doesn't hold the Rav Chista, that the Mocher and the Lokeach have a right to walk away. Haynu eichad delo huzal velo hukar. That is, as long as the market price has not changed, according to Rabbanan and Rav Chisda, either one of them can walk from the transaction. In that case, Rabbi Shimon believes that the seller can walk away because he has the money in his hands, but the buyer cannot walk away from the transaction anymore. And so what he says, based on our Gemara, is trei tare, where there's a possibility of two market prices and cheaper in the future, even Rabbi Shimon in that case gives the lokeach the right to walk. Just like the mocher has a right to walk. And so therefore, Tosfot suggests over here that if there's yukra v'zula, if there's a change in the market price as well, then you can walk away from it even according to Rabbi Shimon. Rabbi Shimon believes the mocher and the lokeach are empowered in the same way to walk away from it. You might be subject to misha para, but you can walk away from it. It's not legally binding. The only time that Rabbi Shimon believes it's legally binding and the Chachamim didn't institute the takana that you need a kinyan mishicha is in the case of a static market price and an agreement between the two parties, then the lokeach is locked, b'kinyan d'oraita, and the mocher has the right to walk away legally because of the chachamim's takana of mishicha. He might be subject to misha para. That's the one place where Rabbi Shimon says the lokeach can't walk away. Any other situation in which there's a change in the circumstance, then even the lokeach has given the right to walk away. Tosfot proves that from our Gemara over here, because here you see that Rabbi Shimon, even though he says back there, lokeach can never walk away, we see over here he says lokeach can walk away when there's another variable involved. That variable is change in price. Whether it's trei tare, it's appreciation, depreciation, he has a right to walk in that case. And therefore, that's what Tosfot said back on Mem Zayin Amud Bet, that Rabbi Shimon, the scope of Rabbi Shimon's statement is much more narrow than we think, based on the Gemara back on Mem Zayin Amud Bet. So now, Amar Lei Rav Acha, Brei Derova, the Ravashi, Vitipuklei. So now, as Rashi notes over here, and so does the Tosafot, this is going back on Rav Papa. Rav Papa, who gave the answer about the Nidunya, he said, well, it depends. What was the agreement between the son-in-law who went out to procure the items and the supplier? So over here, Rav Acha, Brei Derova, says to Ravashi, Vitipuklei, Deshliach Shavya Meikara. Why don't we just suggest that the in-laws made the son-in-law into their proxy, into a shliach, to act on their behalf. And therefore, they're bound by the actions of that individual. Now, what that would mean is, if you are a shliach, So then it would then make the chotein, the father-in-law, the one who is the actual counterparty in the transaction, and he'd be subject to mishapara if he walks away. And that would mean that the son-in-law who acted on his behalf is not liable because he did whatever his father-in-law asked him to do. So in that case, he's acting as a shliach, and then the mishapara would fall on the father-in-law, not on the son-in-law. And so therefore, the son-in-law should not be being held accountable by the father-in-law, because the son-in-law did whatever he was supposed to do for the father-in-law. Now the father-in-law is bound by that because he made him into a shliach.
But that is only true if he carried out his shlichut properly. In our case here, he did something that was along the lines of what he should have done, but not exactly, which is that he entered the transaction, which was what he was asked to do, but he didn't do it in the most efficacious manner where he would save money for his father-in-law. Therefore, we're going to annul the transaction, but had he done something totally incorrect or in violation of the instructions, then we would hold him accountable for the loss, and we'd make him stand by the transaction and make up the difference to his father-in-law. But in this case, we're going to annul the transaction. Neither party should be held accountable here, because in a sense, it was an honest mistake. And as
Rashi says then, once he's a shliach, deinkan mishapara etzel lokeach, nedunya zu. Because then there'll be no mishapara for the purchaser. Because he was really only acting on behalf of his father-in-law, and therefore he's not the one subject to mishapara, it would be his father-in-law. And v'chamiv chozerbo, and the one who's walking away from the transaction is the father-in-law, not the person who entered into the transaction. What could he do? He's not the controlling factor here in the transaction. The person who's paying for it and the person who's buying it is his father-in-law. So if his father-in-law walks away, how can you say you're going to curse the shliach who entered into the transaction? He's not the one walking away. He's not the one that is bound. He was only acting as an agent on behalf of his father-in-law. And the father-in-law can say, I sent him out to be my agent, but that's only if he did the right thing. The expression the Gemara uses, Letikune shedartich. I sent you out to do something good for me. Levute, but if to do mess me up, I didn't make you into my shliach. Or in essence, you abrogated your shlichut when you made a bad deal. You should have said to the supplier, I get the lower of the price today or the delivery price. The fact that you didn't say it, you abrogated your agency and you're no longer my agent. So the agent can't be subject to mishapara because the one walking for the transaction is the father-in-law. The father-in-law can't be subject to mishapara because he says the shliach didn't do what I asked him to do and therefore it's not my problem. And then neither of them will be subject to mishapara and they can walk from the transaction without any problem. So what Rav Acha Bar Rava is saying to Rav Ashi, why didn't Rav Papa say to them, you can walk? Here there's no problem to walk because no matter what the father-in-law does, the shliach is not subject to mishapara because he just was an agent. He wasn't the one deciding now to walk away from the transaction. And the father-in-law can walk from the transaction because he says, the agent, my son-in-law didn't do a good job. He messed up and I don't want him as my agent anymore. It's a case where we're dealing with a merchant who buys and sells. Meaning, shalo shliach naseh. He did not become an agent for his father-in-law. Ela pasakim chadno, v'chadno pasakim acherim. The father-in-law did a transaction with his son-in-law, and then the son-in-law went out to procure it and make money. He is a merchant, and his business is buying and selling. So he sold it to his father-in-law, and then he went out to procure it at a better price than his father-in-law had been willing to give him. So he went out and then entered into the transaction. So the party to the transaction over here is the son-in-law. The father-in-law is one degree of separation because he paid already his son-in-law at whatever price it was. The son-in-law went out and procured it, and now we want to know what price did the son-in-law have to pay the supplier. And if he walks now, the one who's walking is the son-in-law, and he is subject to mishapara. And that's how you explain that case up there, and that's why Rav Papa gave the psak that if he agreed to the lower of the two prices, then that's what he gets. He didn't agree to that, then he doesn't get it, and he's subject to mishapara if he walks away from the transaction. Okay, next Mishnah. Malveta adamet arisav chitin bichitin lezera. A person is allowed to lend to his sharecropper seed to plant for return of that seed at the time of the harvest. Aval lo le'echol. He can't lend him it to eat to return it at the harvest because that's what is otherwise known as sa'ah bisa'ah. You're lending him a sa'ah today to get a sa'ah back later. That you're not allowed to do. But if you give it for him for seed, that you're allowed to do and he can return it to you later on.
Shaya Rabban Gamliel malvet arisav chitin bechitin lezera. Because Rabbi Gamliel had a practice that he used to give his sharecroppers seed to plant in order to get it back. Lezera biyoker behuzlu obzol behukru. If he gave it to them when it was expensive and then the price went down, obzol he gave them cheap behukru and then the price went up. No tell me am kishar azol. He would only make them pay the lower of the two prices. So Rabban Gamliel, even though he had agreed at one time what the price was when he gave them the zera, when it came to the harvest price could be higher or lower. It could be that they are more expensive, the seeds at that point in time, or it could be that the seed at that time is a lower price. Rabban Gamliel would say, you pay me the lower of the price of when you took the seed and the time that you returned the seed. Whichever of those prices is lower, you pay me. Lo mipnei shalacha kein, not because that was the halacha, El Shiratzal Achmir Latzmo. But he's Machmir on himself. You already saw this back in the Gemara with Rav. Adam Choshub Shiny. When it comes to an important person, you have to be careful. And you have to do things that make it clear that you're not accepting rebate. So it might be from that, Rabban Gamliel did this, where he gave them at a lower price. And then when it came back to returning it, they were giving him back kernels or wheat that was worth much more. That looks like rebate. Even though it's totally mutar, it still looks like it is rebate. So Rabban Gamliel, in order to avoid that appearance, says you get it at the lower of the two prices. Whatever price is lower, that's what you pay me for the wheat then, and that's the wheat that you return to me. So basically, you're getting the same price in both locations, and there's no question of rebate. So even though, technically, there's no halachic problem over here, Rabban Gamliel's practice was to be machmir. Again, whether that's because Adam Chashuv Shiny, or simply that he was a person that acted lifnei mishurat hadin, and he didn't want to take it in that way. So that's what the Mishnah comes to teach you, that even though Rabbi Gamliel's practice was that way, that's not necessarily normative. You can give seed to your aris and take back the same quantity of seed in the end, even if the price fluctuates and goes up, it's not considered to be sa'ah bisa'ah. It's not the problem that we have of lending a sa'ah and getting back a sa'ah. That is lechol. If you gave it to him to eat and then you got it back, that would be problematic of sa'ah bisa'ah. Now, why is that different? Tan Rabbanan. When is that true? Shalom Yarad. That's before he went into the agreement to be your sharecropper. Ava Yarad, once he's already agreed to be the sharecropper, asur, then you can't do it. Why does our Mishnah, the lo kamaflik ben yored ben lo yored, ben yarad ben lo yarad, how come our town of our Mishnah makes no distinction or qualification to, as to whether the aris already began or didn't begin yet? Well, Mishnah Tanabara, and why does the Braita, the Kamafli ben Yorad the ben Lo Yorad, why does the town of the Braita distinguish between whether he started or not? Zamarova, Rav Idi Asbara Niali. Rav Idi explained to me this situation. Be'atra the Tana Didan, in the city of our town, I mean the town of the Mishnah, Arisa Yahavi Bizra. It was the responsibility of the aris to provide the seeds. Therefore, ben yarad, ben lo yarad, whether he started working yet or has yet to start working, kama deloya bizdra matzi misalakle. Until he shows up with the seed, the owner can throw him off the property. Meaning that the sharecropper's agreement is that you show up as a sharecropper with the seed to plant the field. That means that our deal, or you're being locked in as a sharecropper, and it's a finalized situation where you're now bound by our agreement, and the owner cannot throw the sharecropper off. It's only when the sharecropper shows up with the raw materials he's supposed to have, which is the seeds. Until he has the seeds, there's no agreement. That means that the sharecropper agreement only begins after he has the seeds in hand. That means when you give him v'chi kanochit, the batzer mihochi kanochit. And that means that when you give him the seeds today at whatever price it is, and then he has to return you the seeds in the end. Basically, what he's doing is he's agreeing to take less in the back end. He is just becoming a sharecropper with a different type of sharing agreement than another sharecropper. Since it's all before you entered into being a sharecropper and locked into a sharecropper, the deal becomes now that you'll take a lesser share of the crop because you owe me the seeds back. And that's fine, because that means it's part of the sharecropper agreement. It's not a lending of sa'basa. Ba'atra the Tana Bora, in the area where the Braita, the author of the Braita lived, Mari Ara Yahab Bizra, the owner of the field supplied the seeds. So Elo Yorod, If he has yet to go to the field and begin working, the Matzi Misalik Lei, and therefore the landowner can annul the sharecropper agreement, then if he forces him then to take the seed and return the seed later on, again, they're just amending the sharecropper agreement. And that means that the agreement is based on you, instead of you taking 30%, you're going to take 25%. And that 5% is going to pay me back the seeds that I gave you. But, Iorad, if he's already begun to work, the lo matzi misalik lei, where you do not have a right then to remove him from the field, then it's a sur. Then it becomes problematic. Because that means that the sharecropper's agreement is already in effect. And you already came to an agreement where he's going to get 30% and you're going to get 70% or the other way around, whatever the nature of the agreement is. Then you go and give him seed to return you seed in the end. Then it becomes sa'ah b'sa'ah. It's not an adjustment in the sharecropper agreement. The sharecropper agreement is already finalized. So now it becomes a problem that you're lending him a sa'ah and taking a sa'ah back in the back end. That's a problem of sa'ah b'sa'ah. So the difference between them is, what is the practice in that area? If the practice in that area is that the sharecropper shows up with the seed, and that's when it's binding agreement, well, until he has the seed, it's not binding. That means when you give him the seed and then make this agreement, you're changing the sharecropper agreement. You're not doing a sa'ah b'sa'ah loan. On the other hand, in a city where the owner provides the seed, then once the sharecropper's there, the sharecropper agreement is finalized, and whatever percentage is already done. So then, when you now give him a seed to get back seed at the back end, you're doing a sa'ah b'sa'ah transaction. If you already catch him before he's gone down to the field, then you can make the sharecropper agreement, whatever you want. And that you're allowed to amend. You're allowed to amend that agreement as long as you haven't been locked in already. And that's the difference between the cases. Tanu Rabbanan, Omer Adam Lechavero, a person can say to his friend, Hilvani Kur Chitim, Bekotzeitz Lo Damim. Says, lend me a core worth of chitim, and it's worth such and such. Who's lo? If the price of the merchandise of chitim went down, notein lo chitim, then he pays him back a core chitim, and he's discharged his obligation. Hukru, if the price of wheat appreciated, then notein to mehem, he just pays him the money that he had borrowed originally, and not the wheat. Mar says, halo katzatz, why is that a chiddush? They agreed to that, meaning that when he gave him the loan, he says, I'm giving you a kurchutim, which is worth such and such. Mm-hmm. Once you've done that, you've already agreed either to accept the equivalent price because you established a price of what you're lending him. Because in that case, no matter what the outcome is, it's really a transaction that involves a monetary fixed price. But you certainly should not be able to pay back with the chitim, which is cheaper now, because they set a fixed value to the loan. And so therefore, giving back cheaper chitim does not discharge your obligation, and that cannot be the explanation of the Braita. This is what I'm saying. If they didn't agree to what the price was at that time, if the price went down, notel chitav, then the person can take his wheat. Hukru, notain de mehem. If the price went up, then he pays cash to him. They have to figure out what the price was at the time. And then he hands him the cash of what that price was at the time that he lent him the wheat. What was the cost of wheat at that time? And then he can pay him back. So in a case where lo katzatz, they didn't set the price, the debtor still has the ability to pay him back in one of two mechanisms. He can either pay him back through paying the actual wheat back, or you can pay him back by the value of the wheat the time of the original transaction. And in that way, then you avoid the rebate problem, because if you enter into a transaction of sa'ah bisa'ah, then this is the way you solve the problem, so it's not a problem of rebate, which is im lo katzatz. If they did not set the price originally, which would have made the whole thing mutar, because in that case, no matter what the outcome is, it's really a transaction that involves a monetary fixed price, which is that you're lending that money and that's all the money you'll get back. That's fine, because there's no mechze to rebeat. Over here, where you enter into a sa'ah b'sa'ah transaction and there is a problem of mechze to rebeat, even though lo katzatz, it's as if it is katzatz, because we force him to rectify the situation so there won't be any problem of rebeat. And how do we do that? We allow the debtor to pay back either merchandise if the price went down, or if the price went up, we allow them to pay the value of whatever it was at the time that they entered into the agreement. And in that way, you avoid the problem of mechze k'ribit if they did not structure the transaction properly up front,
We, nevertheless, in the back end, give the debtor that choice in order to avoid the problem of Mechzei Kiribit. Okay, we're going to stop here by the Mishnah on the top of Ayin Hey Amud Aleph.